Hi there, my name is Saul and you are listening to The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the history of the city in regular weekly chunks. Each episode, supposedly, can stand alone so you can just listen and enjoy it. But as they go along, they build an incredible narrative story of the city, its people, what it went through, what it experienced and what it saw. In this week's episode, we covered the 5 years that saw events outside of London escalate to become really important very quickly. While we do keep coming back to the city to understand what's going to come up in future chapters, we need to cast our net a bit further this episode. We need to see what was going on elsewhere in England and beyond. So we have an episode this week that features Gascony blockade runners, a little remembered attack on the south coast of England, actual Vikings, and yes, Vikings are still kind of a thing, four-year-old girls becoming queens, one of London's most romantic gestures ever, a rough overview of the actual background to the plot of Braveheart, and why the Savoy became a fortress. All of this and more to come. Grab a coffee, get comfy, and welcome to chapter 106 of The Story of London. So we're going to be over the next few episodes dealing with a big war. But where does a war start? I mean, truly start. Often the reasons for it, the seeds that begin the fighting, begin elsewhere to where the war actually happens. For the story of London and the tale that is to come, I need to direct listeners to go all the way back to chapter 72 of this podcast, The Last Vikings and the Birth of the London Irish. Back in that episode, I dedicated an entire chapter to explain, perhaps in too much detail, how the Hiberno-Norse, the name given to the descendants of the Scandinavians who had settled in the Irish Sea region, the Norse diaspora, had become really the last bastion of Vikings in Europe to a degree. I described how the dragon ships of these Norse still ploughed the waterways of the Irish Sea and Scottish islands, how dynasties of Scandinavian-descended nobles still ruled things, how a separate culture still thrived and in some way had become a fifth nation, competing with the English, the Irish, the Scottish and the Welsh. And I described how the invasion of Ireland by Henry II, the traditional starting point of the English intervention in all Irish affairs, had been facilitated and only made possible by a vast fleet of Norse dragon ships supplied by the mercenary lord of the Isle of Man. And so we start the story of the war to come with that region, the Irish Sea, the back door into England, the origin of way more successful invasions of England than Normandy could ever replicate. Because changes in the Irish Sea led to changes in the fortunes of Scotland. And changes in the fortunes of Scotland made it much more important than it had previously been to the English. And this underwrote what Edward I was about to do. So in order to grasp what was going on in Scotland, we need to grasp what was happening with their neighbours, the remnants of the diaspora, of the Vikings of the Irish Sea. Now, it's strange. We don't often realise it, but in truth, this Hiberno-Norse world had not disappeared. It's just that nobody was noticing it, because aside from growing lands in Ireland for 200 years because the kings of England were simply looking in the opposite direction, you'd seen an abdication of English sea power from the Irish Sea, and this had effectively restored the autonomy of the North diaspora of this region. And if you want proof of that, well, you just need to look at what was going on with the Welsh. The Welsh never developed naval power of their own in the Middle Ages, but they always understood and exploited the importance of naval powers around them. You can see that all the way back in 1212, when Llywelyn ap Hiorth of Gwynedd concluded a treaty with the French. And 60 years before our chapter begins, Wales was still the home to a polyglot Irish Sea world in which the English kings really didn't belong. If you want further proof, look at a figure who's around about 60 years before our chapter began, a man called Alan, Lord of Galloway. Now, nominally, he was head of one of the larger clans of Hiberno-Norse, but he also witnessed the Magna Carta. He's named as an English baron. His mother came from an Anglo-Norman family settled in Scotland. His brother-in-law is the Constable of Chester. His father-in-law, the Earl of Huntingdon. Alan of Galloway, who was designated the Constable of Scotland, was said to be the greatest warrior of his day, had a large personal army and a personal fleet of about 200 ships. His kinsman, John the Scot, who became the next Earl of Huntingdon, the heir to the Earldom of Chester, was the cousin of the King of Scots, had married to Llewellyn's daughter Helen, while her sister married William Lacy, the half-brother of the Anglo-Norman Earl of Ulster, and was the grandson of Rory O'Connor, the High King of Ireland. And a generation later, Llewellyn ap Gruffydd maintained links both with Scotland and with Brian O'Neill, the High King of Ireland, and is said to have galleys of his own. All of this just to illustrate that there existed, just below the surface, when we look at medieval England and medieval Scotland, a world that was intimately involved with itself, yet whose origins and cultural touchstones were Viking. And this all existed on the shores of the Irish Sea, bound together by their ships. The kings of England were largely excluded from direct participation in it, and when they did intervene, they always picked the most costly and ineffective manner to intervene. And to say these waters were still the home of actual Vikings from Scandinavia is also not exaggerating. The number of warriors on ships from Scandinavia had been reduced in the 12th century due to prolonged warfare both within and amongst the Scandinavian kingdoms. But they enjoyed a revival from the 1180s onwards and were once again capable of intervening in the British Isles. In fact, in the 13th century, Norwegian kings were building some of the largest warships ever constructed of timber, culminating in the great Kristundin, a 260-foot-long ship built at Bergen for King Hakon Hakkason in 1262. This king, with his giant ships, unequaled anywhere in the northern world, became a direct threat to both England and Scotland. I mean, in 1257, he's providing the Spanish kingdom of Castilla with naval technical assistance. And in 1262, he was negotiating with Eadh O'Connor of Connaught for an alliance against the English. And he also supported the lands of Man and the Hebrides. And I'm mentioning him because in 1263, he took his fleet, led by his flagship, the Kristundin, and entered the Irish Sea, and he attacked Scotland. Why did he attack Scotland? Well, Godfred Olafsson, the Norse king of the Isle of Man, who had brought Henry II to Ireland, went on to produce a dynasty of kings in his stead, the Crovan dynasty, and they'd rule the Isle of Man and been a power on the Irish Sea over the decades that followed. But the Scottish kings, under first Alexander II and then his son Alexander III, had pushed back on the Crovan dynasty's nominal holdings, the Kingdom of Man and the Isles. And they were basically trying to claim all those islands off the west coast of Scotland as being part of Scotland. Eventually, Alexander III claimed the capital of the Kingdom of the Isles, the Isle of Man, and the Crovan in charge, a man called Godfred Magnusson, then appealed to King Hakon Hakonason. And added to that, Scottish forces had just launched a major attack upon the Isle of Skye. King Hakon Hakonason's response to this was to mastermind a massive military expedition of his own, described by Icelandics as the largest force to have ever sailed from Norway. And this Norwegian fleet, that sure as hell looked like Vikings, eventually reached the Firth of Clyde before a long and complicated game of warfare, diplomacy, and politics took place. But the Scots, helped a lot by bad weather, finally obtained victory over these Norwegians at the Battle of Largs. And the Norwegians were fully defeated. It was a massive victory for King Alexander III of Scotland, and in ensuring peace, Man and the Hebrides ended up being ceded to Scotland. And all of this changed the balance of power in Britain completely. Although the English kings never saw it, and few people even realise it to this day, Scotland, after the defeat of the Norwegians, was right now more powerful than England. Maybe not in terms of manpower, but in terms of real politique and the strategic relationship between English and the Irish Sea, Scotland was in the driving seat. You see, because they controlled the largest fleet, and now Scotland had access to these galleys and these fleets, they were the only sea power in the Irish Sea. And that immediately threatened England's control of Eastern Ireland and South Wales at its most vulnerable point. Scotland could now project its will beyond its borders. And you saw that in 1275. Alexander III crushed the revolt in the Isle of Man with a fleet of 90 galleys. If Scotland just took this fleet of 90 galleys and decided to sail south, if they extended their naval reach further south, English occupations in Wales and in Ireland were vulnerable. They had no fleet to compete. Luckily for the English, they did not. And why? Well, the Scots had more pressing issues. Because in 1286, King Alexander III of Scotland died, and he only had one heir. You see, he had a daughter who died 3 years before, but she had married Eric, the new King of Norway, and they had had a daughter called Margaret. And this young girl, King Alexander's granddaughter, was basically the sole heiress to the entire newly empowered Scottish kingdom. Now, young Princess Margaret was only 4 years old when she was nominally accepted as Queen of the Scots. There was no legal problem to her inheriting it. It's just that Scotland never had a queen before. But in view of her young age, however, her father, King Eric of Norway, was very reluctant to see her leave Norway for a very uncertain future in Scotland. The obvious solution was to arrange for her to get married or betrothed, preferably to someone important and suitable. And a plan duly emerged for young Margaret to get engaged to Edward of Carnarvon, Edward the First's son. And we need to take a second to discuss Edward the First's son. Edward had had 16 children, but most of them had died young. And when it came to his designated male heir, Edward was having a run of bad luck. He had had a son called Henry, who died aged 6 in 1274, another son called Alfonso, who had died in 1284, aged 10, and now, in the same year, he had this, his eldest son was called Edward, Edward of Carnarvon, who was only about 2 or 3 years old. And because he was only 2 or 3 years old, and Margaret of Scotland was 4 years old, it was kind of an ideal person to become engaged to the four-year-old, yeah? Edward was certainly active in promoting it, and he sent an embassy to Norway in April 1290 and an embassy to Rome, which was to obtain papal dispensation for the marriage. The Scottish nobles in charge of the country since King Alexander died, the Guardians, they kind of liked the idea as it gave England a stake in helping to keep Scotland stable. And the Norwegian king liked it as it gave him an alliance with the English throne. So, you know, job's a good one. Negotiations between the English, the Scots and Norwegians took place at Salisbury early in 1289, and it was agreed that Margaret should come to Scotland or England by the 1st of November 1290. Assurances were given that while she would be betrothed, she would not actually get married without the consent of the King Edward and the King of Norway. And the Scots agreed to this, and this agreement was ratified by the Scots at Brigham on the 14th of March 1290. Everything is above board. Everything seems fine. And yet there are hints, even back then, that something was going on behind the scenes. There's an entry in the closed rolls that draw curiosity for some. See, at the time, as Edward was getting his tax concessions and expelling the Jews, which we covered last episode, one of his more trusted men did something in London. That man was someone called Robert Burnell, the Bishop of Bath and Wells and the Lord Chancellor of England. And he was one of King Edward's most trusted advisers. Burnell is famed for being the man who Edward I arguably trusted more than any other of his courtiers. He'd made a couple of huge internal changes in the government of England, such as making London the record centre and focal point of the Exchequer, and he'd also turned the King's Wardrobe, the name given to the body that oversaw the King's immediate court and expenditure, into effectively becoming the King's War Office, funding his many conflicts. We find that in February 1290, the King had a private discussion about the marriage of his son Edward with Margaret of Scotland and his future dealings with Norway. But this discussion and the record of it was sealed in secret at Robert Burnell's house in London and were then enrolled in the wardrobe rather than in the formal records of the Chancellery. Something was afoot. Be that as it may, in May 1290, an English embassy sent out to fetch Margaret, the Maid of Norway. Elaborate preparations were made, and when the ship was made ready, it was lavishly provisioned with wine, beer, salt meat and fish, and a stock of luxuries to tempt the young lady, including sugar, spices, almonds, figs and raisins. There was even an organ for her amusement supplies, and bright banners and pennants, so the vessel could be bedecked out in splendour. Unfortunately, there were a few diplomatic and technical problems that had to be overcome, and the envoys returned in June empty-handed. Further negotiations were needed, and this led on the 18th of July, where the Treaty of Brigham was agreed between the English and the Scots. It was confirmed by Edward at Northampton at the end of the following month. This dealt with the arrangements to be made once the young Edward had married Margaret. It stated that Scotland would remain, quote, separate, free in itself without any subjugation to England, and divided by its proper frontiers and marches as in the past, unquote. The Scottish government was to be kept quite separate from the English one, and the relics of the Scottish kingdom were to be kept under seal in Scotland until Margaret had come there and given birth to an heir. These guarantees on Scottish independence show that the guardians of Scotland, the nobles who were running the country, were extremely cautious in their dealings with Edward I, and they had reason to be. Edward liked to flex. On June the 4th, he appointed a man called Walter de Huntingdon with the stewardship of the Isle of Man, claiming that the Earl of Ulster had surrendered it to him and ignoring the stronger Scottish claim to the island. He then gave authority on the 20th of June to Anthony Beck, the Bishop of Durham, to admit the warring inhabitants of the Western Isles to his peace. And then on July 28th, the very day he confirmed the Treaty of Brigham, Edward nominated Bishop Beck to act on behalf of Edward of Caernarfon and the young Queen Margaret in Scotland, quote, to administer justice and set that realm in order, unquote. Beck was going to act in conjunction with the Scottish guardians, and Edward asked them to be obedient to him. Now, there was no evidence that Scotland was needed to be set in order, and Beck's appointment was a remarkable step to take before Margaret had even come to Scotland. And whatever his motives were right now, it is plain that Edward had decided he should exercise a degree of power in Scotland. This situation was becoming volatile, and then it took a turn for the worst. Margaret and her ship sailed from Norway. That autumn, when the ship pulled into Orkney, the young queen died, and Scotland suddenly stared into an abyss. Who would rule the land? There was no obvious heir, and no less than 13 claimants to the throne began to appear. The result was political carnage, it seemed, but in truth, really, even now, from the very beginning, the only important claims were from the two main rivals, John Baliol and Robert Bruce. But then, around 1290, King Edward was distracted and stricken with terrible news. His wife, Queen Eleanor of Castilia, had not really recovered in health since the birth of her last child, Edward of Caernarfon, her 16th. She was still robustly travelling with the king and being part of his regime, though. She had suffered from malaria in Gascony, but bounced back, sold hundreds of former Jewish houses after the expulsion of the Jews from England, and had been involved in the talks regarding her son's engagement to Margaret of Scotland. But her health was weakening, and the king was concerned. We actually think he changed the location of a parliament in her last year so as to prevent the Queen from having to travel too far. She began her final procession through royal lands in 1290, while all of the above was going on, and she sickened. Finally, in a small village in Nottinghamshire, Queen Eleanor was unable to travel any further. She was given the last rites, and with King Edward at her side, passed on the evening of the 28th of November, 1290, aged only 49. She'd been married for 36 years, and it is clear, no matter what anybody thinks of him, King Edward of England grieved for her greatly. Following her death, the body of Queen Eleanor was carried to the nearby town of Lincoln, where she was embalmed, and her remains were then carried to London, a journey of about 180 miles, that lasted for 12 days. As the funeral cortege came to a stop each night, the place where it stopped was to be marked with a cross erected by the king. These crosses, which became known as the Eleanor Crosses, were eventually replicated and enshrined in stone to serve as a monument and a cenotaph for Queen Eleanor. And upon each one in time were carved the words, Orate pro anima, pray for the soul. And I mention this because two of these Eleanor crosses were to be erected in London. The first was the Cheapside Cross, and the second, we today call the Charing Cross. Eleanor's procession into London came from the east of the city. Her coffin had rested in Holy Trinity Priory overnight, and the procession set off again the following day through the city. Passing along Westcepe or Cheapside, it headed to the Franciscan Friary of Greyfriars before it was taken to St. Paul's Cathedral, where it probably stayed overnight as it would not head to Westminster until the following day. The cross then was placed in Cheapside, because Cheapside was the major city street, and it's been clear from finding the sites of the previous Eleanor crosses that the king ensured they were all placed in prominent positions. Edward I wanted Eleanor remembered, so putting a cross in a prominent position would ensure that his late queen was kept in public memory for centuries to come. There are no remains of the Cheapside cross today, however, but we do have a record of its location on the corner of Wood Street and Cheapside. It would become a massive stone structure to be built over the next few years and covered in marble. The Cheapside cross dominated the street and would do for years. The second cross was erected at the corner where the road from London travelled along Fleet Street and then turned left to head into Westminster. This was to be the last of the crosses and the largest one. And the small community of houses nearby, Charing, was where it got its name from and subsequently renamed the region around it. This was the Charing Cross. Its original location you can see today. It's not the tall structure outside Charing Cross train station. That was a much, much later, much, much based in your imagination replica built to advertise a hotel built above Charing Cross train station. No, the original Charing Cross was located in today's Trafalgar Square. Its exact location is where today you find the statue of King Charles I. This Charing Cross remained here until 1647, lasting only a few years longer than the Cheapside Cross, which was demolished in 1643. They remained throughout the story of London going forward as iconic symbols of the genuine love this most brutal king seemed to have had for his queen. Eleanor herself had two burials in London. Her first burial was where her body was laid, in a tomb at Westminster Abbey, located at the feet of the tomb of her father-in-law, Henry III. But her heart was removed from the corpse and buried in Blackfriars. It should be noted that a year from now, in 1291, the king's mother, the Dowager Queen Eleanor, also died, and her heart was removed and buried in Greyfriars in London. Which, given that her original burial place was an unmarked grave in the priory she'd spent her last years in, making her the only English queen without a grave or a tomb, Greyfriars became her only memorial. In many ways, the early years of the 1290s marked a pivotal change in the reign of Edward I. The king remained, but around him, the faces and personalities of his early reign were being lost. The death of his wife and his mother were symbolic of this. Both women had a strong influence on Edward, though that of his mother had declined in the latter years of her life. There was a marked change in the household knights that served the king, as a new generation began to take the place of those who had served with the king through the Welsh Wars of the 1270s and 80s. John Kirby, the king's advisor and trusted member of his royal wardrobe, also got sick in 1290. This was the man who had taken over London and established the wardens to replace the mayors. Because he was poorly, he underwent an operation to bleed him of the bad humours in his blood, and that killed him. The Dean of St. Martin le Grand, a church long associated with the royal wardrobe down in London, a man called William of Louth, who was in charge of the royal wardrobe's budget, was appointed to be the new Bishop of Ely. In 1292, Robert Burnell, who I mentioned earlier, also died, the most important of all Edward's advisers in the first half of his reign. The man who replaced him in the Chancery, John Langton, never approached him in terms of power and influence. And added to this, you had the dismissal of many justices in show trials in 1290 or so, which transformed the senior personnel at courts and the King's Council. And we mentioned the show trials and the reasons for them last episode. And the records of London say what a big thing it is. Quote, in the same year, all the justices were taken and put to ransom for their treason, unquote. Edward was dealing with a period of grieving and also transition. But by 1291, he was back and dealing with the problems in Scotland. And in 1291, the problems in Scotland was who was going to run this country and who was going to decide who was going to run this country. And as a caveat, who had the authority to decide who was going to run this country. And what follows is an incredibly complicated series of events. Legal negotiations about the future of the Scottish throne. The nobles of Scotland felt in many ways they should pick who should be king, but recognised picking a king was not something done as easily as picking a president. A king was ordained by God himself. He was chosen. Across Europe, royalty had a mystical and religious connotation. Now, while we know realistically who was in charge somewhere was often really just a case of moving fast and being brutal with a sword, it was supposed to be more than that. A mystical anointing of someone to symbolically and physically lead a nation. As such, the guardians of Scotland did not have the authority to just pick a king. In truth, the choice of the King of Scotland needed another king to help oversee the process. And the only real other king around, Edward of England. Now, technically, this was a simple deal. The King of England would oversee the inquiries to choose who should be the King of Scotland, and the guardians of Scotland would conduct these proceedings, and between them, they'd find the ideal candidate, legally. Who out of the 13 claimants had the best claim? And on paper, it's dead easy. Of course, it wasn't in practice. Edward insisted that in order to be able to do his side of the bargain, he needed to be granted authority over Scotland. So his rulings on the diverse legal issues that were about to come in had authenticity. The guardians of Scotland were all, no way you're getting authority over us, you wee bobag. And there followed a long series of convoluted meetings, speeches, legal proceedings and diplomacy, coupled with occasional shows of strength. It is incredibly fascinating and also has nothing to do with London, so I'm going to miss it. Anyway, the final stages of the case went quickly in the autumn of 1292. Edward's councillors unanimously agreed on the 3rd of November that due to technical reasons, John Baneal was the best legal candidate. And on the 6th of November, the Scottish auditors concurred with his view and judgment was given against Robert Bruce. Then the demands made by Bruce and another candidate that if they couldn't win, Scotland should be divided up were considered, and after the Scottish representatives were consulted, the decision was made that that had no case. By then, the rest of the competitors had either withdrawn or been told their claims were invalid. And the final judgment on the 17th of November accordingly went to John Baliol, the new King of Scotland. Meanwhile, back in London, Ralph de Sandwich, the warden, stepped down and was replaced by John Le Breton. The two men seem to have got into a rhythm of swapping the roles of warden of the city. And this year, as John Breton took over, he was aided by a dealer in spices and pepper, an alderman of the ward of Baynard's Castle, William Delay, and a man called John Rumier. These two men became his sheriffs. Warden Le Breton seems to have been a bit more active than Warden Le Sandwich when it came to running London, and it's around 1292 that we see him creating the Pig in Pounders of London. See, apparently the Pig in Pounders of London were four men ordered to take any pigs found wandering the streets and kill them unless the owner paid a fine of 4 pence. I like this law because its creation clearly reveals the previously not realised issue the city had with lots of wandering pigs. There was quite a bit going on in London this year, as we know that Robert Gravesend, the Bishop of London, was attempting to enclose two woods of his in the village of Stepney. He was opposed by the citizens of London, who stated that, quote, time out of mind, unquote, they had been used to chase hares, foxes, rabbits and other beasts without hindrance in these woods and were opposed to their enclosure. Meanwhile, down the road in Westminster, St. Stephen's Chapel was begun. This was the king's private chapel. His courtiers worshipped in its crypt, known as St. Mary Undercroft. It was begun this year by Edward I in an attempt to emulate the Sainte-Chapelle in Paris, but was badly damaged by fire around about 1298 and then had to be rebuilt in 1347. And at some point in the future, St. Stephen's was to be used as a chamber of the House of Commons. But while I would love to stay wandering the streets of London in 1292 and avoiding its itinerant pig population, events elsewhere need to be returned to. The English and Scottish legal authorities had just decided John Balliol should be King of Scotland. And despite what movies like Braveheart would have us believe, once judgment was pronounced in favour of King John Balliol, Edward did not hesitate to hand the kingdom over to its new ruler. Now, I will say the year before Edward had formally promised to maintain the laws and customs of Scotland and to restore the realm to its rightful claimant within 2 months of judgment being given, and that if he failed to do so, he would be liable to pay a penalty of £100,000 in aid of the Holy Land. So, this is why he did hand over Scotland straight away, but there was a saving clause within that agreement that preserved his rights in the border region, and he made it clear that he had the right to receive homage from the new king, with all the stuff that went with it, and that sovereign lordship was his. But what did sovereign lordship mean? Well, Edward intended to find out. Edward wanted folks to recognise that while Scotland was free, he was the overboss of the Scottish king. When John Balliol was enthroned at Scone, the ceremony was performed by Anthony Beck, Bishop of Durham, and another Englishman called John de St. John. Now, the fact that two English magnates played such a role emphasised the new relationship between the Scottish Crown and England. And if there were any doubts about Balliol's position, they must have been largely resolved on the 26th of December, when the new king did homage to Edward I in unambiguous terms, which recognised the English king's sovereign lordship. Now, Edward did not live in a time where a man could be content with mere recognition of his authority. He had to exercise his rights in order to establish them. And so a legal case came up soon after. So soon, in fact, some believe it was orchestrated to help Edward make a point. Basically, an English burgess lost the legal case in Scotland and appealed to the English king, who then overruled the Scottish court's ruling. And this caused a big argument about didn't the English king say he would honour Scottish laws and gave Edward the ability to lean on John Balliol. And on the 2nd of January 1293, John Balliol acquitted the English king of all the promises he had made and annulled the terms of the Treaty of Northampton and basically came across as Edward's pawn. To be fair, though, it was kind of expected. Rarely easy in the Middle Ages for a magnate to undergo the metamorphosis into a king successfully, as we'd seen here in the story of London with the tale of King Stephen of Blois. Balliol was the fourth son of a wealthy magnate. He'd held various official positions in England. John had probably been intended for the church and does not appear to have been given any training in war or politics, you know, the kind of stuff needed to become an effective king. His connections were largely with England. His wife was a daughter of an English earl, and he was a landowner with substantial scale in the north of England. And above all, he was in debt to the crown, owing £1,223 to the king, which he was told in May 1293 he could pay off in instalments of £40 a year. John Balliol was King of Scotland, but he was coming across as Edward's glove puppet. Meanwhile, in 1293, down in London, Warden de Breton finished his couple of years in office, and Warden de Sandwich took the post again, and the posts of sheriffs rotating around them, and the city was trying to get on with things. It was growing. A new convent was formed in the area south of Aldgate High Street, called the Minories. It derives its name from the Convent of St. Clair, founded this year by Edmund, the Earl of Lancaster, the brother of the king, and Blanche, his wife. The nuns belong to the Order of Sorores Minores, the Little Sisters. The abbey occupied a site on which St. Clair Street and Hayden Walk now stand. A street called the Minories runs from the old ditch which encircled the city wall. And that Prince Edmund, the Earl of Lancaster, wasn't just doing that. He'd received a gift from his mother after she had passed, some prime real estate on the outskirts of London, the mansion on the Strand called the Savoy. In 1293, around the 21st of June, he obtained permission from the king to strengthen the mansion with a wall of stone and mortar and to castellate the building. The reason for this could well be because the Savoy bordered on the River Thames, and with all the fighting taking place around the coast, turning it into a castle could have been seen as a good idea. Wait a minute. What fighting going on around the coast? I'll get to that. The fortifying of Savoy wasn't the only big building change in London. You see, way back in 1262 or so, when the old Jewish community of London had been attacked and a number of houses were destroyed, by 1275, there'd been erected on the site of some of them a mansion. And this mansion, on the 4th of December 1293, was granted to an alderman of the city called John de Buckel. The house at the corner of Basinghall Street and Gresham Street was then a private residence, but in the future it would become a market for the selling of woolen cloths. We also know there was some shimmering social tension going on in London, as we have records of a successful attempt by a group of men to seize a prisoner being carried off to jail by men working for the sheriff. Three of the ringleaders of this later had their hands amputated by the common hangman in Cheapside in retaliation. But even with all this going on, the records of London this year have to mention of how things in Scotland were now escalating. John Baliol, as we said, was Edward's glove puppet. But by all accounts, the Scots seemed to be tolerating this. But as we reached the summer of 1294, however, Edward took a new step. He summoned John Baliol and 18 Scottish magnates to perform feudal service, aka raised armed forces to march with him, because the King of England was now at war with France. And this changed everything. Wait. There's a war with France? Yeah, this needs to be mentioned. You see, this had all started with the fallout between sailors from Normandy, which was under the French king, and Bayonne, which was in Gascony, which was under the King of England. Sailors from these two regions were involved in scuffles and fights and violence on the water. The Gascony sailors, because they were loyal to the King of England, were soon joined by sailors also loyal to the King of England from Kent and Essex. Now, these small-scale fights on the water began to escalate. And the Normans retaliated by attacking English ports, not just in Gascony, but also on the English coast. And this is why the Earl of Lancaster was probably fortifying the Savoy. Now, I have to say I'm unsure. I've seen reports that round about 1292 something big happened, but others say it was around 1295. But effectively, the fighting between all these sailors escalated. A French Mediterranean galley squadron sailed up the Channel, raided the Channel Islands, burnt the port of Dover, and attacked Hythe and a couple of other places. Any which way you can try to explain it, things had severely escalated. And then on May the 15th, 1293, a major sea battle took place between Norman ships and a combined fleet from Gascony, Ireland, and the Cinque ports. This combined fleet of ships sailing under the nominal flag of Edward I won. Now, how all of this was provoked and who was chiefly to blame are questions that are really difficult to disentangle from the claims and counterclaims, but its consequences were soon clear enough. Not content with victory at sea, the Gasconese went on to attack their ancient rival, the city of La Rochelle, which was under the French king but bordered on lands ruled by the English king. And here they caused havoc and loads of damages. This was a diplomatic disaster for King Edward, because as Duke of Aquitaine, he could be, and was, pulled up in Parisian courts to answer for allowing his Gasconese subjects to fight those of his feudal lord, the King of France. The immediate response from the French, however, to all of this, they decided to occupy Gascony, supposedly temporarily, until the affair would be resolved. And this was bad. The economic value of England's remaining continental province was staggering. After the loss of Poitou, the English abandoned the white wine trades of that territory in favour of the light red wines, or the clarets, from the country around Bordeaux. The wine trade grew in importance until by the early 14th century, over 80,000 tons a year were being exported, and at least 1,000 ships a year were clearing the Gironde River. The duty levied on wine exported through Bordeaux became equal to, sometimes greater, than the customs revenue of the whole of the Kingdom of England, while Bordeaux itself became the largest and richest city of the English king's possessions. I mean, in just 30-odd years from now, Gascony's net contribution to the English exchequer was £13,000. However, the growth of the wine-producing areas, coupled with the loss of territory to the French in the past, made it impossible for Gascony to feed itself. So by the 14th century, English Gascony depended largely on grain, fish and other commodities imported from England. So any interruption of regular convoys threatened famine in Gascony, as well as financial disaster for the English crown. The greatest seaport in Gascony was the wealthy city and loyal city of Bayonne, whose ship owners handled much of the wine trade and contributed, well, as we've just seen, a heck of a lot of English naval strength. And now the French had it. Edward I needed it back. And even though this was supposedly a temporary measure, he wasn't naive enough to imagine that he would get it back without fighting. So, he immediately set about assembling the ships and men required for a major expedition. All he needed was a plan. And Edward looked back at the failed plans of his father and grandfather had used. They'd thought to defend Gascony by concentrating on an offensive alliance from in Flanders. Now, yes, this policy had failed Henry III, and yes, it had failed King John. And so Edward decided, with all the cunning of the fox, that the last things the French would expect would be for him to do the same thing again. See, genius, the French would never expect us to invade from the north, and so Edward made plans to do the same. Despite the fallout that had taken place a few years before, close economic ties had long formed the foundation of alliances between Flanders and England against the French. So with this war in France now starting, and with a bit of fighting down in Gascony, Edward hoped that fighting could start in Flanders. And this was the reason he demanded the Scottish king, John Baliol, should supply him with men in order to be able to facilitate this grand plan. But by asking for it, he revealed that the game was changing. The war in Gascony took the recently established status quo in Britain and turned it on its head. But before explaining how, I just need to just tell you how that war was going, because Edward sent what small forces he could be spared from Wales to Gascony. The first ship sailed in October 1294, passing up the River Gironde, past Bordeaux, capturing a couple of places and riverside towns along the way, before disembarking after 17 weeks at sea, marched overland, retook Bayonne, and were welcomed as a relieving force at once. So, initial success. But Edward needed cash to pay for this, and he ordered the, the ransacking of churches and monasteries throughout England to get that cash. Apparently, he ordered the seizure of £2,000 from St. Paul's Cathedral in London, which caused the Dean of London and St. Paul's to die of a fit. He probably also took the money when the Bishop of Chester established a London house built to the south of the Strand as part of today's Somerset House. It was later, under the name of Strand House, to be one of the inns of the Chancery. But with the cash to cover it, it couldn't disguise the fact that his forces in Gascony were very small. And by Easter 1295, a large French army invaded Gascony. With few English troops available, the burden of the war fell largely on local forces raised by the towns and petty nobility. The 1295 expedition of the king's brother, Edward, Earl of Lancaster, achieved little, and the Earl of Lancaster himself died in June. It looked as if the English possessions in Gascony were doomed. But then, cometh the moment, cometh the saviour. And the saviour of the English possessions in Gascony was a captain, Barras de Sescas, the captain and admiral of Bayonne. Bayonne's ships and money were the key to the defence of English Gascony. They fought the convoys from England through the French blockade of the Grion River to the besieged fortresses and allowed them to hold out until the truce could be established in 1297. We actually have quite a bit of information about these operations, and there's one in particular I like, the story of a ship called the Plenty, which was masted by a man called Robert Kingston, and which carried from London to these besieged English people fighting in Gascony 385 quarters of corn, 20 tons of wheat, 3 sprig ales, 48 crossbows, and ammunition amounting to 52,000 crossbow bolts and 50 sprig ales bolts. What an insight into London in this era. London supplying materials to allow a Gascon captain and blockade runner supply English and Gascony troops besieged in castles down in the south of France. However, all of this going on changed the deal with Scotland. Edward's war with the French injected a new and dangerous element into Anglo-Scottish relations. Not only did it provoke Edward into making unprecedented demands upon the Scots, but it also gave the Scots a potential ally against the English. Before this time, it would have been foolhardy to try and resist Edward. Now they could seek the assistance of King Philip IV of France. One interpretation of the immediate origins of the war against the Scots, which is going to break out in 1296, was as a central element of the political revolution of Scotland in 1295, where power was taken from Balliol by the Council of Twelve and the Treaty of Alliance made with the French. The ratification of this treaty in February 1296 was tantamount to declaration of war against Edward. Meanwhile, because the English were so hard-pressed and any naval forces they just had were now sailing down towards the French coast, and because the Scots were getting slightly more independent-minded, the Welsh saw that if they could rebel, they could stand a chance to throw off their shackles, which brings us back full circle. The English didn't have the fleets to be able to cover a war protecting Wales and against Scotland and against the French. They were hard-pressed. And is it any surprise, as 1295 turned into 1296, England's enemies saw an opportunity. Edward I was about to find himself being attacked on all sides, and London was to find itself praying for its very soul. Orete pro anima, Londinia. Okay, that's the setup leading into next week's episodes, where we cover the events that are covered, I suppose, in the movie Braveheart, but from a London point of view. So yeah, we get to kill William Wallace. I'll be back again next week for another chapter in the story of London. Hope you enjoyed that one. This is Saul saying, see ya.